Chapter 2
"The boat ahoy!"
roared the leopard's marine sentry, meaning, "What boat is that? Whom does it convey?" The question was unnecessary, since La Flèche lay not a cable's length to windward, and all the leopards, with time to look over the side, had seen her captain get into his gig in reply to the admiral's signal, pull ashore in splendour, return an hour later with an official package, certainly dispatches, go aboard on the larboard side of his ship, silently reappear with a parcel of quite a different shape, and pull straight for the leopard. A question unnecessary for information, but nevertheless of great importance, since nothing but the coxswain's answering roar of "La Flèche!" could set the proper ceremony in train. The performers were pitifully shabby, the ship herself devoid of paint, but the rite was carried out in every detail. Side boys as brown as Malays and almost as bare darting down to offer the man-ropes with hands ludicrously gleaming in white gloves run up by the sailmaker, the bosun's call wailing as he and his mates piped the side, the rugged marines presenting their bright arms as Captain York set foot aboard and saluted the quarter-deck. Byron, the officer of the watch, and therefore as respectable as his means would allow, received him. And a moment later Jack Aubrey, having had time to clear the cabin of wombats and to put on a pair of whole trousers, emerged from his cabin.
"York," he cried, "welcome aboard. I'm delighted to see you."
They shook hands, and Jack introduced his officers, Babington, Moore and Byron, and those of his midshipmen who were at hand, while all the time Captain York studiously avoided seeing the leopard's squalor, and then led him aft. As soon as the cabin door closed behind them, York said,
"I have a letter for you, Aubrey," pulling it from his pocket. "I took the liberty of waiting on Mrs. Aubrey on my way down to Portsmouth, thinking that just in case the leopard had, that is to say, had reached the East Indies, you might like news of her."
"What a good fellow you are, York, upon my soul,"
cried Jack, growing suddenly red with delight. He took the letter and stared at it with his bright blue eye.
"You could not have given me greater pleasure short of bringing her out to me yourself. Amazingly good-natured in you. I take it very, very kindly. How was she? How did you find her? How did she seem to be going along?"
"Most uncommonly well, I do assure you. Overflowing spirits. Came downstairs singing. I've never seen her look so well. She had a brand new baby in her arms and kept laughing at it for being so perfectly toothless and bald."
"Oh," said Jack.
"A new nephew or niece of yours. I forget quite which. I had put on a pretty solemn face, I can tell you, what with that ugly tale of the boats, and with Leopard being so damnably overdue, so I was taken aback to find her brimming over with spirits, even more so when she laughed and said she would be obliged to me if I would bring you out some warm stockings. Indeed, I was so put about that I could hardly follow her explanation. But it seems she had had a letter from America to say that all was well. I forget the details, though she showed me the letter. She had it in her bosom. Not that she had needed it, she said. She had always known perfectly well you were safe, but she was infinitely obliged to the sender, and the moment she received it, she had set to work on a new set of active service linen and some more stockings. She had not needed the letter, however."
"It must have been the American brig that put into Desolation Island when we were trying to put ourselves to rights," said Jack, laughing for joy. "Honest, good-hearted fellows, though you would not think so to look at them. Ha, ha, ha! Bless 'em! There is good in everybody, York, even an American."
"Certainly there is," said York. "I have half a dozen in La Flèche at this moment, and prime seamen they are, every man jack of them. I pressed them out of a Salem bark a little south of Madeira. They cut up rough at the time, but they soon made the best of it, capital fellows."
"You did not see the children, I suppose?"
said Jack. No, but I heard them. They were singing the Old Hundredth."
"Bless 'em,"
said Jack again, and he cocked his head.
"That must be my surgeon coming aboard. You will like him. A reading man, too. Most amazing learned. A full-blown physician into the bargain, and my particular friend. But I must tell you this, York, he is wealthy."
In point of fact, Captain Aubrey had little idea of his surgeon's fortune, apart from knowing that he owned a good deal of hilly land in Catalonia, with a tumble-down castle on it. But Stephen had done pretty well out of the Mauritius campaign. His manner of living was Spartan, one suit of clothes every 5 years, and perhaps a couple of shirts, and apart from books he had no visible expenses at all. Jack was no Machiavel, but he did know that to the rich it should be given, that capital possessed a mystical significance, that even the most perfectly disinterested respected it and its owner, and that although a naval surgeon was ordinarily a person of no great consequence, the same man moved into quite a different category the moment he was endowed with comfortable private means. In short, that whereas an ordinary surgeon, living on his pay, might not readily be indulged in room for exotic livestock, an imperfectly preserved giant squid, and several tons of natural specimens, in a stranger's ship, a wealthy natural philosopher might meet with more consideration. And Jack knew how Stephen prized the collection he had made during their arduous voyage.
"He is wealthy, and he only comes with me because of the opportunities for natural philosophy, though he is a first-rate surgeon, too, and we are very lucky to have him. But this voyage the opportunities have been prodigious, and he has turned the leopard into a downright ark. Most of the desolation creatures are stuffed or pickled, but there are some from New Holland that skip and bound about. I hope you're not too crowded in La Flèche."
"Not at all," said York. "We brought out a quantity of soldiers and their stores for Ceylon, and now there is plenty of room. Plenty, that is to say, for a 20-gun post-ship."
"So that is a 20-gun post-ship," said Stephen Maturin to Babington, as they stood by the rail, looking out over the sea at La Flèche. She was unusually beautiful in her pure lines, unbroken by quarter-deck or forecastle, a flush-decked ship, and her strongly raked masts gave her a dashing air. She had recently been repainted with a blue streak, slightly darker than the perfect sea, up to her ports, then a band of white, with the black port lids dividing it, and then a lighter blue, while discreet gold twinkled with the ripple at her head and stern. She had been titivated off to the nines for the admiral's inspection, scrubbed by the lifts and braces, sails furled in a body with never a wrinkle, and as she lay there, framed by the wooded Kampong headland a mile or so beyond her starboard bow, and a low sandy island with a few palm trees far on her quarter, she might have been something without weight or earthly substance, ideal, self-existing, belonging to another dimension. 10 portholes I see on this side," he went on, "and no doubt there are 10 more on the other, which makes the same number of guns as she is alleged to carry, for once. But as for the post, I cannot make it out at all, unless it is that odd, slender pole at the back."
"No, sir," said Babington, "that is the ensign staff, I believe. We all have them, you know. No, they call her a post-ship, because she is commanded by a post-captain. I mean, she is a 6th-rate, the smallest ship a man can be posted into. You follow me?"
"Imperfectly. She has a curious, touching beauty of her own, however. But tell me, Mr. Babington, is she not very small?
Why, I should imagine she would gauge about 450 ton to our 1,000 or so. I dare say you're thinking about your collection, sir."
"I am, too. Yet perhaps there are not many people in her. Perhaps room can be found. The sea elephants can be unstuffed and folded up.
Her complement will be 155, including the boys. And then, of course, there are all of us, the passengers."
"Oh, dear. Oh, dear," said Stephen in a low voice, and he was about to suggest that the leopard's midshipmen would be far better off running about in the sun and fresh air of the East Indies than moping themselves into a thesis in an overcrowded berth, when Babington left him at a run. Captain York was leaving the ship, the usual compliments attending him. Stepping into his gig, he called up,
"At the turn of the tide, then? She should cast pretty at the turn of the tide, and I should not like to lose a moment of this monsoon." "At the turn of the tide," answered Jack, looking at his watch. And then turning to Stephen, he said, "Captain York is very handsomely clearing his whole forepeak for you, and all your dunnage must be aboard within the hour. Mr. Babington will give you a party to rouse it out, and you must supervise its stowage. La Flèche's boats will be alongside as soon as I am relieved. There is not a moment to be lost."
Stephen was used to the shocking abruptness, the inhuman promptitude of naval decisions. The cry of "lose not a minute" had echoed in his ears from his first day in the service. But never had he been expected to be required to transfer the fruit of so many months of patient toil from one ship to another in 53 minutes. The minerals alone weighed several tons. His mouth opened in protest, but he knew that there was no hope, closed it again, and stared distractedly around.
"This way, sir," said Mr. Forshaw in his clear treble pipe, leading him to the fore hatchway, "and I just where the sea elephants are stowed. Mind the step, sir, and clap on with both hands."
Mr. Forshaw often protected Dr. Maturin, whom he regarded as a worthy man, but quite unfit to be let out alone. Yet in spite of the young gentleman's protection, and that of the first lieutenant, and the willingness of the party, and the kindness of a great many other leopards who lent a hand as soon as their own messmate's property was shifted,
no great task, since they carried almost all of it on their backs, and the rest would scarcely fill a ditty bag, while a single sea-chest was enough for two officers. In spite of all this, the doctor spent a most hellish afternoon, hot, hurried, stifling, and above all extremely anxious. He never even noticed the arrival of the Admiral's nominee, who took over command when the ship abruptly turned into a sloop, being now in charge of a lieutenant. Cheerful hands whipped the never-ending giant squid to the topmast yardarm, burst into ribald laughter, words and gestures at the appearance of the male, the very male sea elephant, tossed jars of animals in spirits from hand to hand, irreplaceable specimens of incredible rarity. And aboard La Flèche it was worse, far worse. Here the people did not know him. Here the first lieutenant, instead of being a young man Stephen had known since Babington's precocious puberty, a steady friend, was a grey, severe disciplinarian who took it very ill that the squid should leave a long, greenish-yellow trail on his topsail, his main course, and the attendant rigging, and that a wombat should have forgotten itself on the quarter-deck. And here what he had always feared would happen did in fact take place. In the darkness of the forepeak, the seamen got at the double rectified spirits of wine in which his specimens were preserved, and presently their mirth increased extremely, while at the same time their dexterity diminished. At one point, Forshaw plucked him by the sleeve and told him to come and say goodbye. They were off. They were homeward bound. He scrambled up from the gloom to the brilliant sunshine, and there, broad on the starboard beam, lay the poor, battered old ship that had so very nearly been their coffin. She was already further off, and as La Flèche sheeted home her topsails, the remaining leopards uttered a thin cheer.
"Huzzay! Huzzay! And give them our love on Portsmouth Hard!"
Stephen waved his wig, his hat had long been lost from sight, and watched her as the turn swept her aft and far astern. Then he plunged below. It was worse than ever. The smell was like gin row mingled with something of Billingsgate, many of the specimens being fish. The voices were louder, the fooling more evident. Two ship's boys were openly playing tug-of-war with a sealskin. By a violent exercise of authority, together with a few hearty kicks and blows, Stephen rescued the skin and a basket of albatross eggs that was within an ace of being trampled underfoot, as La Flèche, under t'gallants now, heeled to the monsoon. Yet no sooner had he preserved one basket, one penguin, one blue-eyed shag, but another was in danger, either from mere levity or from mistaken, blundering goodwill. And now the ship was out of the sheltered anchorage. Now she was taking the swell on her larboard bow, so that the forepeak and all within it was in a state of perpetual motion. In his anguish, Stephen did not hear the tall master's mate say,
"The captain's compliments, sir, and he begs the favour of your company at dinner."
"Silence, fore and aft!"
roared the young man, and in the pause he repeated the invitation, adding,
"That will be in 3 and 20 minutes, sir."
"I cannot conceivably leave my collections tossing to and fro. They cannot possibly be secured before nightfall. Pray tell the captain with my compliments that I shall be glad to wait upon him at any other time. Honoured, happy."
"You, sir,"
projecting his voice into the darkest corner,
"put it down this minute."
5 minutes later, the grey lieutenant appeared. When he could command Dr. Maturin's attention, he said,
"There must be some mistake, sir. The captain invites you to dinner. It is the captain who invites you to dinner."
He had changed his fine coat for a round working jacket, and in the gloom Stephen did not recognise him.
"My dear sir," he said, "you see the state of affairs in this bedlam, this purgatory. Surely you must perceive that it is impossible for me to abandon even what is already here, let alone all that is still upstairs. First things must come first."
Mr. Warner remonstrated, spoke of
"an appearance of disrespect, unintentional, he was sure," and referred to "natural curiosities"
in an unfortunate manner. The tone rose until Stephen, having himself cracked one of his very few whale bird's eggs, turned on him and said,
"You are importunate, sir. You are indiscreet. You oppress me with your civilities. I beg you will go about your affairs and leave me to mine."
"Very good, sir. Very good, mister,"
said the first lieutenant, swelling, and at the same time growing even more rigid.
"Your blood be upon your own head."
"What blood, now, I wonder?"
muttered Stephen, returning to his fragile crates.
"Double, double toil and trouble. Oh, you infernal set of maniacs! Brute beasts.
The next to interrupt his anxious busyness, his inefficient attempts at tying down cases, baskets, chests, with string, and at controlling his helpers, was Captain Aubrey himself. Jack did not address him first, however. To the oldest seaman there, he said,
"What is your name?"
"Jaggers, Your Honour. Carpenter's crew, starboard watch."
"Very well, Jaggers. Jump up to the main deck with your mates. Tell my coxswain and steward I want them here at once."
"Aye, aye, sir."
The sailors vanished silently upwards, like bulky, inebriated mice. Not a hoot nor a halloo until they were well out of sight.
"Stephen,"
said Jack, quickly tricing a wandering basket to a stanchion.
"You are in a sad way, I see."
"So I am too," cried Stephen, "with these bestial Goths, these drunken Huns all about me. I could weep from mere vexation. So much to be preserved, so much already lost. Would you have another piece of string in your pocket at all? And there was a prating fellow that would insist on my dining with the captain of this vile machine. I sent him about his business, told him to go trim his sails."
The vile machine took a lee lurch, and the female sea elephant slid to starboard. Jack waited for the weather roll, heaved it back, passed a line round its middle, made all fast, and said,
"Yes, that was Warner, their first lieutenant. Stephen, there is something about the Navy I should have told you before. A captain's invitation cannot be refused."
"Why not, for all love? Oh, for a decent ball of string."
"The immemorial custom of the service requires that it should be accepted. It is, as who should say, a royal command, and refusal is near as a touch of mutiny."
"What stuff, Jack? In its very nature, an invitation implies an option, the possibility of refusal. You could no more compel a man to be your guest in the sense, the only valid sense, of a willing commensal, a glad partaker of your fare, than you can oblige a woman to love you. A prisoner is not a guest, a raped wench is not a wife, an invitation is not a new case."
Jack abandoned the immemorial custom of the service, though it had answered well before. There was only 4 minutes to go.
"Hold fast!"
he called up the scuttle, and in a low voice he said,
"I should take it as a particular favour if you were to come. York has asked you out of kindness to me. It would be a most unfortunate beginning to the voyage if there were any appearance of slighting him. Unfortunate for me and all our shipmates."
"But Jack!"
cried Stephen, waving hopelessly at his tumbled collections, most in uneasy movement, all threatening decisive motion.
"How can I leave all this?"
"Bondon and Killick will be below directly, both sober, and both carrying any amount of cordage, and all the other leopards will give you a hand as soon as dinner is over. Pray be a good fellow for once, Stephen."
"Well,"
with an unwilling look at all he was leaving,
"I will come so. But mark you, brother, it is only in compliment to you. I do not give a fig for your immemorial tyranny and oppression, nor for his Tsarist Majesty back there."
"Bondon! Killick!"
called Jack. They instantly dropped through the scuttle, Killick carrying what remnants of uniform Dr. Maturin still possessed, a clean shirt and a comb, for he knew perfectly well what was afoot. Leopard's surgeon, mad with drink, had refused the captain's invitation. It was confidently expected that Mr. Warner would have him brought aft in irons, that his jaws would be prized open with a hand spike, and his dinner poured down his throat, whether or no, that he should be placed under close arrest, forbidden to move from his cabin for the remainder of the voyage, and court-martialed the moment La Flèche reached Pompey. It was with a certain feeling of disappointment, of anticlimax, therefore, that they saw him pass, at a shambling run, square-ribbed and fairly trim, in his own captain's wake, at 1 minute to the hour.
"You will be civil,"
Jack whispered in his ear at the cabin door. Stephen's non-committal sniff gave him no comfort, but immediately afterwards he was relieved to see Stephen's courtly leg and bow, to hear his urbane, "Your servant, sir." Stephen was, after all, a man of high breeding, though wonderfully ignorant of seafaring ways. Once, when he was attending a levee, Jack had seen him walking about, perfectly at home, familiarly known and indeed caressed by a surprising number of people, some of them very grand. Ignorant though he was of naval customs, Stephen did at least know that guests under the rank of captain were not expected to speak to the commander of the ship until they were spoken to. It was an extension of the court etiquette.
He sat mute, therefore, looking amiable, while they drank a pint of sherry and ate up their fresh turtle soup. He looked round the cabin, the only book-lined cabin he had ever seen, row after row of books, and low down, built in among the quartos, the sheet music, and the incongruous 9-pounder gun, a small square piano. Jack had said that Captain York was a musician, and evidently he was a reader too. No man carried books to sea for show. He could make out some of the nearer titles, Woods Rogers, Shelvock, Anson, the immense Histoire Générale des Voyages, Churchill, Harris, Bougainville, Cook, all natural enough in a sailor. Then Gibbon, Johnson, and stretching away and away, the Kale edition of Voltaire. Above Voltaire, an even greater number of small octavos and duodecimos, whose labels he could not distinguish. Novels, in all likelihood. He looked at their owner with greater interest. A dark man, rather plump, with a clever face, about Jack's age, but by no means so obviously a sailor. He looked capable, but Stephen had the impression that he loved his ease.
"We were very nearly late," said Jack. "I absolutely burst a stocking pulling it on. The yarn completely rotted. Those that you brought out could not have come at a better moment. And the doctor was having a devil of a time stowing his philosophical creatures and their eggs." "J'ai failli attendre, as Louis XIV put it," said York with a smile. "How deeply shocking. I dare say you have noticed, Dr. Maturin, that sea captains assume a kind of regal state. It may at times seem rather comic, but I am sorry to hear that your creatures were giving difficulty, and even sorrier when I reflect that perhaps my invitation was ill-timed. Can my people be of any use? Our Jemmy Dux was a sow-gelder on shore, and he is a great hand with both bird and beast."
"You are very good, sir, but my living specimens are perfectly well-behaved. They are sitting in my cabin in rows, staring at one another. No, it is the inanimate objects that caused me some anxiety as they tossed about."
"But that is all in hand now," said Jack. "My coxswain is in the forepeak, seeing to the stowage. It will be perfectly safe now. And, most fortunately, the doctor did not trust all his eggs in one basket. Oh, no, there are dozens of them, each with a different kind. Albatrosses, petrels, penguins."
Captain Aubrey could not finish. His mirth choked him. All his eggs in one basket was not perhaps the very highest point of wit, but it was pretty lofty for him, and it was his own. And he drew so much honest merriment from it that his face, already mahogany red from the sun and the wind, turned purple. His eyes vanished, and he laughed his deep, intensely amused laugh until the glasses rattled. York watched him affectionately, and Stephen, noticing this, warmed to the captain of La Flèche.
"You have not changed much since the old Rezzo, Aubrey," said York at last. "I hope you still play your fiddle." "Yes, I do," said Jack, wiping his eyes. "All in one basket. Ha, ha, ha! Lord, I must remember to tell Sophie that when I write. Yes, I do. And I see you have risen to a piano forte. How do you keep it in tune?"
"I don't," said York. "I have a key, and I make my attempts, but it is a sad, jingling little box after all. How I wish I could press a piano tuner. Yet I could not do without it. I could not do without some sort of music all these months at sea."
"I am entirely to your way of thinking. The doctor and I scrape away, although his cello and my fiddle have suffered cruelly. Glue and varnish almost gone, and our bows obliged to be replenished from the longest pigtails the crew could provide."
"You play the cello, sir?" Stephen bowed.
"I am delighted to hear it, and I very much hope we may have some music together. I am sick of the sound of my own voice, and a captain, you know, hears little other."
The dinner wound its comfortable course. Captain York had a far better cook than most, and while the sailors sat with their port, Stephen wandered among the books.
"Where do you stow them all when you clear for action?" asked Jack,
following him with his eye.
"They are in interlocking boxes, you see," said York. "It is my own invention. You only have to turn the toggle behind Richardson, and they're all free. The bar in front of each keeps the books from falling out, and the boxes can be struck down into the hold in a moment. Well, in a couple of moments. Though, to tell you the truth, I do not make a clean sweep fore and aft quite as often as I ought. Certainly not as often as my first lieutenant would like. If he had his way, we should be as bare as a barn every time the drum beat for quarters. Not a cabin, not a bulkhead standing, everything in fighting trim."
"Is he a great fire-eater, then?"
"Oh, he longs for action, of course. He would give an arm and a leg to be made, like all of us, before we reached post-rank, and an action is his only chance. He had no interest at all, poor man.
and the years are going by.
You spoke of Richardson, sir, said Stephen, who had taken down the first volume of the Histoire Générale, and who was looking at the Abbé Prévost's round, cheerful face. Some months ago I learnt that the Abbé Prévost translated him into French. I was astonished. It was a lady who told me this, he added, nodding to Jack.
I am astonished too, said York. I should never have thought he could find the time, with his own splendid works and all those voyages too. Richardson is thousands and thousands of pages long, a travail de Benedictine. Yet if I remember right, Prévost actually was a Benedictine, though perhaps somewhat irregular at times, but in any case, who more suitable than the author of Manon Lescaut for Clarissa Harlowe? Such penetration, such awareness of the mind that is not aware of itself. You have read Richardson, sir, I make no doubt.
I have not, sir. The lady of whom I spoke urged me to do so, and I did indeed look into the first volume of Pamela. But the ship was sinking, the captain in a state of wild alarm, continually turning to me for advice, and it did not seem to me that the time was quite propitious for such an enterprise.
Certainly Richardson calls for a long period of calm. He is not lightly to be embarked upon. But now you have it, my dear sir. Months of calm before you. I touch upon wood, absit omen. Months of mental calm with only your few leopards to look after, since for ourselves we have an excellent surgeon and young Mr. McLean. Let me entreat you to launch into Pamela again, and then Clarissa. Grandison I cannot quite so heartily recommend, but I believe that even Dr. Maturin's understanding of human nature might be increased by the first two. Pray take the first volume of Pamela with you now. It is just above your head, and come back for the others when it is done.
I never was a great reader, said Jack.
His friends looked down at their wine and smiled.
I mean, I never could get along with your novels and tales. Admiral Burney, Captain Burney, then, lent me one wrote by his sister when we were coming back with a slow convoy from the West Indies. But I could not get through with it. Sad stuff, I thought. Though I dare say the fault was in me, just as some people cannot relish music, for Burney thought the world of it, and he was as fine a seaman as any in the service. He sailed with Cook, and you cannot say fairer than that.
That is the best qualification for a literary critic I ever heard of, said York. What was the name of the book?
There you have me, said Jack. But it was a small book, in three volumes, I think, and it was all about love. Every novel I've ever looked into is all about love, and I've looked into a good many because Sophie loves them, and I read aloud to her while she knits, in the evening. All about love.
Of course they are, said York. What else raises your blood, your spirit, your whole being to the highest pitch, so that life is triumphant, or tragic, as the case may be, and so that every day is worth a year of common life, when you sit, trembling for a letter, when the whole of life is filled with meaning, double-shotted.
But to be sure, when you actually come to what some have called the right true end, you may find the position ridiculous and the pleasure momentary. But novels, upon the whole, are concerned with getting there. And for that matter, what else makes the world go round?
Why, as to that, said Jack, I have nothing against the world's going round. Indeed, I am rather in favour of it. But as for raising your spirits to the highest pitch, what do you say about hunting, or playing for high stakes? What do you say about war, about going into action?
Come, Aubrey, you must have observed that love is a kind of war. You must have seen the analogy. As for hunting and deep play, what is more obvious? You pursue in love, and if the game is worth engaging in at all, you play for very high stakes indeed. Do you not agree, Doctor?
Sure, you are in the right of it. Inter missa, Venus diu, Rursus bella moves. And yet perhaps full war, martial war, may wind even more emotions to the breaking point. The social emotions of comradeship, extreme joint endeavour, even patriotism and selfless devotion may be involved, and glory, rather than a humid bed, may be the aim. The stakes are perhaps higher still, since physical annihilation accompanies defeat. But how is this to be encompassed in a book? In a venereal engagement, between a man and a woman, the events occur in turn, in a sequence of time. Each can be described as it arises. Whereas in a martial contest, so many things happen at once that even the ablest hand must despair of drawing the appearance of a serial thread from the confusion. For example, I have never yet heard two accounts of the Battle of Trafalgar that consist with one another in their details.
You was at Trafalgar, York, said Jack.
Who knew that if Stephen were not brought up with a round turn, he might go on for hours and hours?
Pray tell us how it was.
He turned to Stephen, adding,
Captain York was second of Orion, you know, a line of battleship.
Well, as you know, said York, I was in charge of the slaughterhouse guns, so I did not see a great deal once the fun began, and I dare say my account will conflict with all those Dr. Maturin has heard hitherto. But up until then I had a wonderful view, because we held our fire longer than any ship in the fleet, and Captain Codrington called us up to see it all. Orion was in the rear of the Windward Division, we lay ninth, with Agamemnon ahead and Minotaur astern, and as we bore down, I could see the whole of Collingwood's division and the enemy's line clear from the Bucentaur down to the San Juan de Nepomuceno. They lay thus, placing a series of biscuit crumbs, and these are their frigates. No, I will fetch a box of toothpicks and cut them in half for the frigates. Two weevils crept from the crumbs.
You see those weevils, Stephen? Said Jack solemnly.
I do.
Which would you choose?
There is not a scrap of difference. Arcades ambo. They are the same species of curculio, and there is nothing to choose between them.
But suppose you had to choose?
Well, then I should choose the right-hand weevil. It has a perceptible advantage in both length and breadth.
There I have you, cried Jack. You are bit. You are completely dished. Don't you know that in the navy you must always choose the lesser of two weevils? Ooh-ha! Ha-ha-ha!
I like your friend, said Stephen, rejoining Captain Aubrey after a hurried visit to the forepeak, where he found all the leopards sitting companionably among the perfect order of the collections.
I was sure you would. There is not a better-hearted fellow in the service than Charles York. Do you know, he called on Sophie on his way down to the ship, although it was out of his way, and he was in a hellfire hurry, posting down with dispatches, merely to bring me news of her in case we had survived. A damned unlikely chance. But she knew we had. Don't that amaze you, Stephen?
It does. Yet from your overflowing spirits, your inordinate amusement at a couple of wretched clenches, and your general boisterous conduct, I was aware that something had pleased you. Will you tell me how she knew?
Jack hesitated for a moment.
Diana told her,
he said in a strange, awkward tone, entirely at variance with what had gone before.
Diana Villiers?
Yes. I hope I have not wounded you, Stephen. I thought it better to be frank.
Never in life, my dear. I am exceedingly happy to hear it, and to hear of her. Will you tell me more now?
Well, it seems that the Mrs. Wogan who gave us the slip with Herapath on Desolation was acquainted with Diana, and that on getting back to the States she told her all about her adventures and about us, about the Ice Mountain, the boats going off, the reaching Desolation, the coming of the whaler, the then state of the ship, and so on. And Diana, smoking what the state of affairs must be at home with us so long overdue, sat down without losing a moment and dashed off a letter to Sophie, telling her that all was well. I take it very handsomely in her after all that has passed. So does Sophie. Swears she will never again say an unkind word. However, that is to say she takes it very kindly too. I have her account here,
he said, tapping his pocket.
Only a quick scrawl wrote while York was waiting, but full of love and joy. And she sends both to you, Stephen. Longs to see you safe at home. Sweetheart, wrote Jack in his daily letter,
a letter that now amounted to a moderate book, since, unless his ship were either sinking or in action, he could not go to sleep without adding to it, and since he had not been able to send any part of it away since the remote days of Port Jackson, a letter that was quite pointless now that in the natural course of events he would be his own postman.
Sweetheart, I had your dear letter this morning, brought me, together with a very welcome stockings, by that fine good-natured fellow York. I have never been so pleased in all my life, as in knowing that you and the children are well, and that you are not fretting your heart out after that unhappy business with the boats, and the rumours that must have gone about when Grant brought the launch to the Cape. It was very kind, very handsome and considerate in Diana to write so quick. I had misjudged her. She has a good heart, and I shall always value her for it. I told Stephen straight out, and he said he should have expected it of her. She was a gentlemanlike creature, he said, with no pitiful spite or rancour about her. For his part, he is in fine spirits, and better than I have seen him for years. He had a splendid run ashore, for a man of his tastes, on Desolation, and then again at Botany Bay, and some other parts of New Holland where we touched, and he filled the Leopard with some very curious animals indeed. But Leopard is mine no more.
The survey proved she could not carry anything above a few 9 or 6 pounders without she was rebuilt, so she is to be a transport. And since they have given me a caster, I'm coming home as fast as La Flèche can fly, with Stephen, Babington, Byron, my remaining mids, and Bondon and Killick. You would laugh to see Killick looking after Stephen, as he has been doing ever since Stephen's servant, a half-wit, went away in the boats. Stephen is very unwilling to be looked after, but Killick has taken it into his head that it is his duty, and sews on buttons, washes and darns his 2½ shirts, irons his neckcloth, brushes his only decent coat, and makes him shave at least once a week by steady nagging in that grating voice of his, in spite of any amount of abuse. It is like an old angular mother hen with a fractious chick. He turned him out quite presentably for dinner with York today, but he is working on what he thinks is the proper kind of wig for a doctor to wear, making it out of spun yarn crimped at the galley fire. Perhaps it will be an improvement on the horrible old scratch bob that has survived so many storms and broken eggs and dank, mossy plants. York gave us a capital dinner, with roast buffalo, a pair of ducks, a ragout, and a roly-poly pudding, and he and Stephen got along famously, as I hoped they should. People may say that York is no great seaman, but he is a very good fellow, and he drank his 2 bottles without turning a hair, and in any case he has an excellent premier, a man by the name of Warner, who drives the ship at a tremendous pace, almost as fast as I could wish to see her eat up the 15,000 miles between us. They will be 250 less at noon tomorrow, believe, for now we have sunk the land, we have the full monsoon, and Warner is on deck at all hours, in jib, out jib, wetting the royals and t'gallants as though we were in chase of a golden fortune, and leading the foremast jacks a pretty dance of it. La Flèche was always a good sailor, like so many of your French flush-deck corvettes, but Warner gets more out of her than I should have thought possible. He may have persuaded York to give her foremast a trifle more rake than is quite right, but he is a fine seaman, and at the moment we are making 11 knots 1 fathom. It is a pity that he and Stephen should have contrived to fall foul of one another, but so it is. There was some disagreement before dinner, and then a kind of hairy thing between a bear and an ape behaved unsuitably on the quarter-deck, and then there is a rule here that no smoking is allowed anywhere but in the galley, and Warner pointed it out. It is a good rule, but perhaps he might have put it more tactfully. Still, we have thousands of miles of sweet sailing before us, I hope, and being homeward bound, with everybody in a good humour, no doubt they will come to love one another before we reach soundings. I was amazingly witty at dinner, for your letter was as good as wine to me, and there was wine as well. There followed a description of the wit, and Jack went on, "As for that damned fellow Kimber, sweetheart, never let your mind be tormented. If the worst comes to the worst, and if he ruins us, the girl's portions are safe, and I always have my pay. The moment I am home, I shall call him to a pretty sharp account, I promise you. Until then, I intend not to vex my spirits, but to indulge in idleness, high living, sweet sailing, and music. And perhaps I shall attend to my youngsters more than I have been able to do up to the present. In the nature of things, they have necessarily come to some notion of practical seamanship by now, but their notions of navigation are very strange. Young Forshaw is a good boy, far prettier even than his sisters, though no doubt adolescence will soon cope with that, but sometimes I doubt he knows the odds between east longitude and west, which would be a disadvantage to a mariner, particularly to a mariner in hurrying round the world to his wife. And so good night, my dearest soul."
In another part of the ship, Stephen Maturin, having no one to confide in, wrote to himself, to the Stephen Maturin of some future period, who alone could read this private, encoded diary. "So Diana wrote. A generous, handsome motion on her part should not surprise me, since it is perfectly in character. Meanness was never among her faults. Yet I am absurdly pleased. Herapath said of his Louisa Wogan that even when she was lying with other men she still remained his friend, and either he or I observed that deep friendship, as men understand it, is rare in women of the common sort. On a smaller scale, Wogan resembled Diana in many ways, perhaps also in this. I like to persuade myself, I easily persuade myself, that Diana Villiers retains a friendship, even a tenderness for me." A pause, and he wrote, "Wallace's report on the situation in Catalonia is the most interesting I have ever read. If only half of what Mateur states is true, the prospect has never been so full of promise. But how they need a man they can all trust, to act as a link between the different movements, and to coordinate their efforts with those of the British government,
in this case the government as represented by the Navy. Now that the French have killed Enjôme, I do not think there is a man better qualified than myself. I long to be there. But longing will not affect the countless miles of intervening sea, and I shall spend these months with my collections, happy in possessing such a wealth of time, though years would not be too long for a sound scientific description of all the specimens. Some music and reading, too, I trust. Captain York seems a polite, amiable, and literate man, no mere sea officer. He has neither read nor travelled in vain. My companions in the gunroom I have scarcely met. I hope they will prove more like their captain than their first lieutenant, for on them the social comforts of this voyage must in a large degree depend. The social comforts of the gunroom were meagre enough, and after the Leopard's spacious, well-lighted wardroom the place itself seemed cramped. Warner was a mere sea officer. His one aim in life seemed to be to make La Flèche run through the water at the greatest possible speed consistent with the safety of her masts, and although he was not one of those spit-and-polish first lieutenants whom Stephen looked upon as the bane of the Navy, he was no very good company either, except perhaps for those who could speak knowingly of kites, moonsails, and stargazers. He seemed to take no pleasure in anything, and in him the naval love of punctuality reached something not far from mania. He was far older than any other officer in the gunroom, and he ruled its proceedings with a firm and gloomy authority. Like the second lieutenant and marine officer, Warner was a tall man, and since La Flèche had been designed for swift-sailing, stunted Frenchmen as far as her tween decks was concerned, Stephen's first impression of the gunroom was that of a low, thin, shadowy place, inhabited by three unnaturally large bowed figures, all looking at their watches. A fourth walked in immediately afterwards, bringing with him the smell of stale tobacco, alcohol, and unwashed clothes. A man even taller, even more bowed beneath the beams, and Warner introduced MacLean, the surgeon. He was a young man, and he seemed almost paralysed with shyness. At all events, he remained profoundly silent, apart from an awkward plunge and grunt when Warner pronounced his name. Presently the drum beat, and the room quickly filled, and when all were present, with their servants standing behind their chairs, there was scarcely room for the gunroom steward to carry in the peas pudding and salt pork. The purser, the last man in, received a significant look from Mr. Warner, a look that moved slowly from the purser's face to the watch still exposed in Warner's hand. But there were no harsh words, perhaps in honour of the guests. Babington and Byron brought the sun with them, or if not the sun itself, for the gunroom had no stern window, then at least some of the warmth and cheerfulness that Stephen had always associated with any gathering of sailors. They found a fellow spirit in the master, and presently their end of the table was in a fine flow of conversation, reminiscence, anecdote, and laughter, former shipmates recalled, other commissions compared. Stephen laid out some pains in being agreeable to MacLean, who sat by him eating voraciously with a good deal of noise, but until halfway through the meal there was little or no response. Then at last, persuaded that Dr. Maturin was neither going to snub or scorn him, MacLean said,
"I hear your rebukes,"
adding something that Stephen could not catch, the accent being so strong, the voice so lowered in embarrassment. But judging by the young man's expression, the words were obliging, so Stephen bowed, murmuring,
"You are very good, too kind. I believe, sir, you are a naturalist yourself."
"Yes. As a wee bairn, MacLean first scalped a mickle, while his daddy had wang it wi' a stain, and then ilka beastie that came his way. Comparative anatomy had been his joy from that day to this, and he named some of the beasties whose inward parts he had compared. But since the Scooty Allen, the Parton, the Clocky Doo, and the Gowk seemed not to convey any precise idea, he followed them with the Linnaean names. Stephen did the same for the creatures he referred to, and from this it was no great way to Latin descriptions of their more interesting processes. MacLean was fluent in the language, having been to Jena, and Stephen found him far more comprehensible. Presently they were talking away at a great rate, with barely a word of English but Ochai and Hutua. They were deep in the cecum of Monodon Monoceros, when Stephen, becoming aware of a silence on his right, looked up and met the delighted grin of Babington and Byron.
"We had just been boasting about you, sir," said Babington. "We said you could talk Latin to beat a bishop, and these fellows would not believe it."
"Delke," cried Warner, obscurely displeased by all this. "Draw the cloth."
and as soon as the execrable port had appeared,
"Mr. Vice, the King!"
Stephen blessed His Majesty, mastered an involuntary grimace, felt in his pocket for an amboyna cheroot, recollected himself, and said,
"When you are at leisure, Mr. McLean, I shall be happy to show you some of my collections."
McLean stood up at once. He was the doctor's man directly, he said, if he might but have leave to pass by the galley for a pipe, this last with a nervous glance at Mr. Warner.
"The galley? To smoke tobacco? I will join you," said Stephen, "please to lead the way."
And to himself he added,
"There is some inherent imbecility in my will. No sooner have I rid myself of one addiction than I plunge into another. How I long for my cheroot! I will return to snuff."
They were not wanted in the galley. All the smokers of the watch below were already there, and an awkward silence greeted the arrival of the officers. Silence and disapproval. Their own doctor they were used to. They did not cordially like his presence in the galley at any time, since it stood to reason he clapped a stopper on any kind of free conversation, but they were used to him. They might not always like what they were used to, but it was dead certain that they would always loathe what they were not used to, and they were not used to this new doctor. The leopards might crack him up, and he might in fact be handy with both saw and pill, but at present the flitches, for flitches were they called, only wished that he might fall down dead. In time this was borne in upon Dr. Maturin, not by any words or even by wry looks, but by sheer moral force alone. He threw his half-smoked cheroot into the galley range and said,
"Come, colleague, let us go."
This was the beginning of a close association. It was also the beginning of the pleasantest voyage that Maturin had ever made. The monsoon bore them steadily west and south over a limitless and amiable sea, with never an island, never a ship, and rarely a bird to recall them to any sense of the terrestrial, clouds their only companions. It was a seaborne life, ordered by an exact sequence of bells and of naval rites, the sound of the decks being holystoned, swabbed, and flogged dry in the early morning, hammocks piped up, the forenoon tasks, the ceremony of noon itself, when a dozen sextants shot the sun from La Fleche's crowded quarterdeck, and Captain York said,
"Make it so, Mr. Warner!"
The boatswain and his mates piping the hands to dinner, the fifer fifing them to grog, then the drum for the gunroom's meal, the quiet afternoon, and the drum again for quarters and for retreat, the piping down of hammocks, and the setting of the watch. All these were perfectly familiar to Stephen. But what was less familiar, and what in time came to have a hypnotic effect, as of living in the heart of an illusion, was the fact that these rites were never interrupted by the usual emergencies of the sailor's life. No sudden squalls, no untoward calms broke the smooth run of days. La Fleche sailed across the ocean, across a vast disk of sea whose limits always remained the same, neither nearer nor further. She sailed, untroubled by the enemy, by storms, by crime aboard, and presently she might have been sailing forever. Stephen was cut off from the past, and the future lay at so great and indeterminate a distance that it had little reality. His leopards and McLean's flitches were healthy, and however unreasonable it might appear, salt beef, salt pork, dried peas, hard work, far too much rum, stifling quarters and little sleep kept them so. Their surgeons had little to do in the physical line, and every morning after breakfast they repaired to the forepeak, where they sorted, classified, and described the wealth of desolation and New Holland, discovering fascinating analogies between these forms of life and those with which they were more nearly acquainted. On one occasion, they withdrew to a lair behind the bits, McLean's own domain, where by powerful lanterns they dissected, sometimes far into the night, amidst a strong smell of alcohol and other preservatives. McLean was not a drinker. The spiritus reek he carried with him was innocent. But he was a smoker, a very heavy smoker, and it was in his lair that he told Stephen how he defied the first lieutenant, keeping his pipe perpetually lit. McLean was a respectable young man, the son of a crofter, who by extraordinary perseverance and exertion had acquired enough knowledge of medicine to qualify himself for a naval surgeon's career, and a much greater fund of anatomy, which was his delight. He was an admirable colleague for this kind of work, accurate, conscientious, learned, and wholly devoted to his chosen pursuit. He had studied under the illustrious Oaken at Jena,
and he knew an immense amount about the bones of the skull, of all skulls, considered as highly developed vertebral processes. He was prodigiously ignorant of literature, music, and the common graces, but he would have been ideal, from the scientific point of view, if he had not absorbed so much of the learned German's metaphysics that even his respect for Dr. Maturin could not keep him from emitting them together with clouds of smoke. On the more human plane, he could be a tedious companion. He rarely washed, his table manners were offensive, he was extremely umbrageous, and finding that Dr. Maturin was an Irishman, he gave full vent to his dislike for the English. Thon Southron loons didna ken cleanliness, nor it seemed did they ken anything else much, until the hunters had taught them anatomy. They profited shamelessly from the Union, and they despised their betters. A pure wambler set of boggarts, where would they be without Scotch generals? Stephen had no great love of the English government in its dealing with Ireland. In fact, he had actively conspired against it. But he was deeply attached to individual English men and women, and in any case he did not like anyone to abuse the country but himself. "You are mistaken, Mr. MacLean," he said, "in supposing that the English have no generals. They have, and the truth of the matter is that all of them who accomplish anything, such as Lord Wellington, are Irish. Much the same applies to their writers. Let us return to the parietal foramen and the anomalous carnassial teeth of this otaria. At the present rate we shall not have described half the fossidae before we reach the Cape, nay, before we reach England, and they are decaying fast. Pray take care of your tobacco pipe, Mr. MacLean. It is leaning on the spirit pot, and you are to consider that should it take fire, all the specimens we have already described must infallibly be lost." Stephen's days were busy, and in spite of the gloom of the gunroom and of MacLean's shortcomings, most unusually enjoyable. His evenings were usually spent in the cabin, playing music with Jack and Captain York as the ship ran on and on, urged by Warner's unremitting zeal. He often dined there too, escaping the gunroom's purely naval conversation and Spartan fare, for whereas La Fleche's officers had nothing but their pay, York was possessed of comfortable private means. He kept a table, and nearly every day invited two or three of his officers or young gentlemen. After one of these dinners, at which the first lieutenant, the master, and Foreshaw had been present, Stephen was walking on the quarter-deck to air his mind and to dispel the fumes of the captain's port before rejoining MacLean in the depths. The fine quartering breeze had slackened, and it had also drawn more astern, so that there was little refreshment in it, and in spite of the awning the sun beat down with more than common force. It was a make-and-mend day, and the flitches were scattered about the deck, forward of the mainmast, quietly sewing and darning. But Warner had scarcely taken a couple of turns, looking up at the rigging and laying his hand on the braces before he gave an order. The placid groups among the guns broke up in an apparent chaos. Three sharp pipes of the boatswain's call. The chaos resolved itself into a pattern. Another pipe, and the ship spread her stunsails. The booms bent, settled to the strain, and the speed increased perceptibly. At the same time, what little refreshment there had been died quite away. Stephen took off his coat and folded it absently, his mind dwelling on the question of the anomalous otaria, with four roots to its carnassial teeth. If in fact it should prove to be a distinct species, which seemed likely, he should name it after MacLean. That would be a handsome compliment, a gleam of fame more valued than an appointment to a line of battleship. It would also far outweigh the short answers Stephen had given recently, when MacLean had been more than usually wearisome about the English. Like some other Scots he knew, MacLean seemed to labour under some sense of inferiority, and to labour rancorously. Strange, it could never occur to an Irishman, and yet the situation of the two countries. Here a cascade of small coins, a snuff-box, a tinder-box, a spunk-box, a penknife, two lancets, a cheroot case, a duodecimo Horus, some pieces of rosin, a variety of small bones and mammalian teeth, and a partially eaten biscuit, fell from his inverted coat pockets onto the deck. Foreshaw helped him pick them up, gave him some advice on the proper, the seaman-like way of folding a coat, warned him against creasing it and against undue exposure to the sun, and said he should carry the coat down for Killick to hang it up in the doctor's cabin. The cabin was, of course, below, but Foreshaw's road took him by inconsequential leaps along the top of the hammock cloths, with nothing between him and the white, racing water but a little slippery canvas.
Just as he was about to dodge between the forecourse and its deeper stunsel, he lost his footing in a way that would have made Mrs. Forshaw turn deathly pale, and that did make Dr. Maturin feel anxious for his coat. But he seized the sheet and hung there for a moment, laughing up at a friend in the foretop, before vanishing between the sails as safe as a young ape in its native wood. And as he balanced there in his best cabin-going uniform of silver-buckled shoes, white breeches, and blue coat, with his teeth flashing in his sunburnt face and his hair streaming in the wind, he looked uncommonly fetching.
"Can you imagine anything more beautiful?"
said Warner in his harsh, grating voice.
"Not readily," said Stephen.
"Cracking on, when the sun is bright, has always been a joy to me," said Warner quickly. "And now we have just about everything abroad that she can bear."
"A noble spread of sails, upon my word," said Stephen.
And indeed he was by no means unmoved by the beauty of sail above sail, sail beyond sail, taut, rounded, and alive, nor by the huge, curved shadows and intricate geometry of line and brilliant surface. But whereas he had often seen a ship under royals and stunsails, aloft and alow, tearing through the deep blue sea with a bone in her teeth, he had rarely seen such a look of hunger combined with something else, admiration, or rather wonder, affection, tenderness.
"Poor man," he reflected, "the instinct so very strong, so very nearly unconquerable even in a phlegmatic. If he is, as I suppose, a pederast, small wonder he should be glum. When I consider what desire has done for me, how it has torn my heart, and mine an avowable desire, glorified by specious heroic names, I am astonished that such men do not consume themselves entirely. A hard fate, to be shut up day after day with such a longing in a ship, where everything is known, and where this must not be known, where there must be no approach to an overt act."
The Flitches were no brighter than the next ship's company, but as Dr. Maturin observed, there was little they did not know of what went on aboard. They knew the nature of Warner's inclinations, for all his ceaseless, rigorous control. They knew that their captain was an indolent, easy-going, good-natured man with little ambition to rise and shine in his profession or anywhere else, that he would fight like a good'un if called upon to do so, he had given proof of that, but that he had no restless urge for action, that he was quite content with a small post-ship rather than a dashing frigate, and that although he would rather have been sent up the Mediterranean, where he could contemplate the Greek remains, he was happy to carry dispatches to and from the Indies, leaving the running of the ship to his capable first lieutenant. They knew that the boatswain and the carpenter had contrived to move a surprising quantity of the ship's stores to unfrequented places, and they had little doubt that these objects would vanish once La Flèche reached the Cape. The only question was, who shared? They knew a great many other things, some of no importance whatsoever, such as that the Leopard's midshipmen were finding the voyage a burden to their spirits. Jack Aubrey was a conscientious captain. He thought it his duty to form his youngsters, most of whom had been entrusted to him by friends or relations, not only into officers who understood their profession, but into reasonably moral and socially presentable beings as well. During the first part of the Leopard's voyage, he had delegated much of this to the schoolmaster and the chaplain. Then, from the time these men vanished, he had had little leisure for education, but now the whole day was his own, and he devoted far more of it than they liked to leading his reefers through Robinson's Elements of Navigation, Norrie's Epitome, and Gregory's Polite Education. For his part, Jack had received precious little education, polite or otherwise, and he learnt a great deal from Gregory as he went along, an exact list of the kings of Israel, among other things. There were no doubt conscientious captains at the time of the Spanish armament, when he first went to sea, but those he had sailed with had confined themselves to seeing that their midshipmen's drinking and whoring were kept within limits, limits that varied according to the captain. Only one of his early ships had carried a schoolmaster, a gentleman who passed his waking hours in an alcoholic haze, so that apart from a term or two at school by land, where a little Latin had been beaten into him, he was, from the point of view of literature, as the beasts that perish. Seamanship, of course, had come naturally to him. He was a born mariner, and then he had fallen in love with mathematics, a late love, but fruitful. Yet in the new, smoother, more scientific navy that was coming into being, this was not enough.
His youngsters must add a powerful dose of Gregory to their Robinson. He made them read The Present State of Europe Impartially Considered. He saw that the journals they were required to keep would meet the inspection of the severest board of examiners. He stood by while his coxswain taught them the finer points of knotting and splicing. It was a pity that his material was so indifferent, so refractory to anything but the knots and splices, for his intentions were of the best. In some commissions he had had midshipmen who loved the mathematics too, who doted upon spherical trigonometry, so that it was a pleasure to teach them navigation. It was not the case at present.
"Mr. Forshaw," he said, "what is a sign?"
"A sign, sir," said Forshaw, speaking very fast, "is when you draw a right line from one end of an arc perpendicular upon the radius from the centre to the other end of the arc."
"And what is its relation to the chord of that arc?"
Mr. Forshaw looked wild, gazed about the day cabin that Captain York had given over to his guest, but found no help in its neat fittings, its skylight, nor in the 9-pounder gun that took up so much of its space, nor in the blank and hideous face of his companion, Hollis, nor in the title of the novel, The Vicissitudes of Genteel Life. A life aboard La Flèche might not be particularly genteel, but it was certainly full of vicissitudes. After a long pause, he still had no views to offer, other than that the relationship was, no doubt, pretty close.
"Well, well," said Jack, "you must read page 17 again, I see. But that is not what I sent for you for. That is not the reason for which I sent for you. There was a great deal of correspondence for me to attend to at Pulau Batang, and I have only now reached this letter from your mother. She begs me to take great care that when you brush your teeth you will brush them up and down, and not only sideways. Do you understand me, Mr. Forshaw?"
Forshaw loved his mother dearly, but at this moment he wished she might be deprived of the power of holding a pen for ever. "Yes, sir," he said. "Up and down it is, not only sideways, sir."
"What are you tittering at, Mr. Hollis?" asked Captain Aubrey.
"Nothing, sir."
"I come to think of it, I have a letter from your guardian, Mr. Hollis. He wishes to be assured that your moral welfare is well in hand and that you do not neglect your Bible. You do not neglect your Bibles, any of you, I dare say."
"Oh, no, sir."
"I'm glad to hear it. Where the devil would you be if you neglected your Bible? Tell me, Mr. Hollis, who was Abraham?"
Jack was particularly well up in this part of sacred history, having checked Admiral Drury's remarks on Sodom.
"Abraham, sir," said Hollis, his pasty, spotted face turning a nasty, variegated purple. "Why, Abraham was—"
But no more emerged, other than a murmur of bosom.
"Mr. Peters."
Mr. Peters expressed his conviction that Abraham was a very good man, perhaps a corn chandler, since one said, "Abraham and his seed forever."
"Mr. Forshaw."
"Abraham, sir,"
said Forshaw, whose spirits had recovered with their usual speed.
"Oh, he was only an ordinary wicked Jew."
Jack fixed him with his eye. Was Forshaw making game of him? Probably, judging from the extreme innocence of his face.
"Bondon,"
he called, and his coxswain, who was waiting outside the door with sailcloth and rope yarn to learn the young gentleman to make foxes, walked in.
"Bondon, seize Mr. Forshaw to the gun and knot me that rope's end."
"Golden days, Doctor, golden days," said the master of La Flèche to Stephen Maturin.
Far, far to leeward, an enormous dust storm in Africa had raised such a veil that the sun, setting behind it, suffused the clean sea air with an amber light, turning the waves jade green, though in a few minutes it was to make one of its more spectacular disappearances in crimson glory, when the same waves would show deep amethyst. Stephen was standing on the quarterdeck with his hands behind his back, his lips pursed, his eyes fixed, wide open, seeing nothing, upon a ring bolt. He uttered a low, whistling sound.
"I said these were golden days, Doctor," said the master, rather louder, smiling at him.
"So they are, too," cried Stephen, starting from a dream of Diana Villiers and staring round. "Such a light as Claude might have painted, had he ever been to see the creature. But you are speaking figuratively, no doubt. You refer to the ease of our progress, the prosperous gale, the ocean's amenity."
"Yes, I never touched sheet or brace right through the middle watch, and not a hand but took a cork, bar the lookouts and the man at the wheel. Never was there such a run. At least 200 mile logged regular from noon to noon without a break. Golden days.
Oh, maybe it has been a bloody day for him, nodding towards Forshaw, who walked slowly, awkwardly, towards the forehatch, his chin trembling, his companions urging him in a whisper,
to bear up, old chap, and not let those effing flitches see.
For a knot of grinning reefers stood by the larboard rail.
There is always something in the misfortune of others that does not displease us, observed Stephen. Will you look at the wicked, malicious glee of those snotty midshipmen now? Poor child. I shall poultice him with the best linseed mash, and a comfortable analgesic, too.
A pause.
But golden days, as you so rightly say, master. Now that I reflect, I cannot remember ever having passed my time so pleasantly at sea. If it were not for the health of my marsupials, I could wish nothing changed at all.
Do they pine, sir?
They miss their filth. That is to say, the wombats miss their filth. Their quarters are cleaned out most rigorously twice a day, and sometimes, I have reason to believe, by night. Now I am aware that in a man of war there is no place for filth. Perhaps no place for a troop of wombats either, yet I cannot but regret it, and shall be glad when we reach the Cape. I have an excellent friend at Simonstown that keeps a number of contented aardvarks in purely nominal captivity. To him I shall confide my marsupials. Do not think, however, that I intend the least reflection on La Flesh. A most... He had been about to say commodious machine, but the sight of well over 100 flitches swarming about the narrow deck with a great number of empty water casks made him change the word to well-conducted.
It will not be long, Doctor, for although it looks bloody in the west just now, Lord, how the deck shines red, I think I can promise you the breeze will hold, and unless my reckoning is sadly out, tomorrow we shall raise the land.
The master's reckoning was true. La Flesh made as pretty a landfall as could be wished, and the following dawn she glided in under topsails with the tide right down Simon's Bay to the well-remembered anchorage. A wonderfully silent progress after all these weeks of strong winds loud in the rigging and the water racing along her side. Silence, with the shore moving past. A prolonged and dreamlike silence, shattered at last by La Flesh's salute, the roaring acknowledgement, and the splash of her best bower. From that moment on, all peace was at an end. A ship carrying dispatches was required to come and go with even greater haste than the ordinary man of war. La Flesh set about completing her water as though her life depended on catching the next tide but two. Stores and wood and provisions flowed into her, and some flowed secretly out. Again and again Stephen heard the words, "Lose not a minute!" Again and again he fagged along the dusty road to Cape Town in a rickety cart full of wandering marsupials, confined beneath a net, until he found them a suitable haven. For his friend Van der Poel had moved house, aardvarks and all. He was so active on shore that it was not until La Flesh was standing out to sea and her captain sitting down to his dinner that he heard of the United States declaration of war. The news was received with mixed feelings aboard La Flesh. Some of the officers who still felt strongly about the War of Independence welcomed it. Others, who had American friends, or who thought that the whole affair had been shockingly bungled by the Tories and the army, and that in any case a desire for independence was natural, regretted it. Others again left politics to politicians, but supposed that if they had to fight the Americans as well as Bonaparte and his allies, then it was all part of their calling, and at least there might be some hope of prize money. The glorious days of Spanish treasure ships were gone forever. French prizes were precious thin on the ground, but American merchantmen had taken to carrying much of the world's trade, and they might be met with anywhere at all. Bondon told Stephen that upon the whole the lower deck was not pleased. Apart from the regular man-of-war's men, they were mostly hands taken out of merchant ships or pressed on shore. Many had sailed in American vessels, and all had had American shipmates. Although they liked the notion of prize money, they could not see much sense in fighting Americans. There were half a dozen Americans aboard at this moment, and they were practically the same as Englishmen. No airs or graces about them, and you could not say fairer than that. Fighting the French was different. They were foreigners, and somehow it came natural. But generally speaking, the whole ship's company looked upon this new war as a matter of no great importance. There might be some advantage in it, but as a contest it was neither here nor there compared to the war with France. No details had reached the Cape, but everybody knew that the Americans did not possess a single ship of the line, whereas the Royal Navy had over 100 actually at sea, to say nothing of those building or in reserve. Yet although the issue of the war, as far as it concerned the sailors, was a foregone conclusion, The Royal Navy had, after all, spent the last 20 years beating every fleet that was brought against it, taking, burning, or sinking the enemy in the mass or in detail wherever he floated. Captain York, for one, was doubtful, if not despondent, about the outcome on land. If the Americans had beaten the British Army in 1981, they might do so again, particularly as so many of the best regiments were engaged in the peninsula. And then the French in Quebec could scarcely be expected to show much zeal on the English side. What he feared was a sudden crossing of the border to take the naval base of Halifax from behind. That would be extremely inconvenient. But even so, he was quite happy about the naval side. There were the West Indies, there was Bermuda, there were, of course, the home bases, and he and Jack fell to working out the composition of the squadron required to keep the American Navy in check, or to destroy it, in the event of a general engagement, on the assumption that Halifax was gone. They had always taken a keen professional interest in the navies of other powers, even of so young a power as the United States, and when Stephen asked, "What does the American Navy consist of, pray?" they were able to answer him at once.
"Apart from their sloops and brigs, they have only 8 frigates, said York. 8. No more. It would be stark-staring madness to declare war with only 8 frigates, when your opponents have more than 600 cruisers at sea, if you meant to do anything in the naval line. But of course their real aim is Canada. They cannot mean to do anything at sea except for snapping up a few prizes before their ships are taken or blockaded in the Chesapeake."
8 frigates, said Jack. 2 of them we should scarcely call frigates at all nowadays. A 32 and a 28 by the name of Adams. Then 3 18-pounders, rated 38 guns apiece, much the same as ours, though perhaps a little beamier, Constellation, Congress, and Chesapeake. And then 3 more, heavier than anything we have, President, Constitution, and United States, all rated 44 guns and all carrying 24-pounders. I dare say a Castor will be ordered to the American station to cope with them, together with Endymion and Indefatigable. I shall like that. There is splendid shooting behind Halifax.
When you say heavier than anything we possess, do you mean in physical bulk, or in the magnitude of their artillery?
I really meant the guns. They have long 24s, as opposed to our 18s. They fire balls that weigh 4 and 20 pounds, rather than 18. 6 pound more, do you see? Said Jack kindly. But of course, one goes with t'other. The American 44s must gauge about 1,500 ton, while our 38s are only a trifle over 1,000. A Castor is 1,160, if I don't mistake, and she carries 40 18-pounders.
Would not this preponderance give the enemy a great advantage? Suppose he were to dash his beakhead against you, would not his greater mass bear you down, as the Turks were borne down at Lepanto?
Dear doctor, said York, those are galley tactics. In modern scientific war, mere weight does not signify, except that the thickness of your scantlings is some protection to your gun crews at long range and enables you to carry heavier guns. A yardarm to yardarm, it does not make much odds. An 18-pounder ball will do just about as much damage as a 24, if the guns are well pointed and well served. When I was 3rd of the Sibyl, 38, we set about La Forte, of 44 24-pounders, and when we took her we found we had killed and wounded 125 of her people, while they had only killed 5 of ours. We dismasted her entirely, too, and lost not one of our own. That was in 1999.
And then in Trafalgar year, said Jack, Tom Baker, you remember Tom Baker, Stephen, the very ugly, carroty-haired man with a pretty wife that dotes upon him, Tom Baker in Phoenix, 36, and an uncommonly small 36, took Dydon, 40, in a very bloody fight. But I tell you what, York, it will never do to send too many liners. You cannot expect any frigate, 44 or not, to come out and engage with a ship of the line. Now I suggest a Castor, Egyptienne.
Stephen's attention wandered, and presently he took up his cello, whispering over the strings. He had made his views on this hurtful, unnecessary war, unnecessary and yet, with such a ministry, perhaps inevitable, clear to Wallace long ago. He was not going to repeat himself. What preoccupied him was the effect it might have upon Diana Villiers, pinned in what was now an enemy country, and upon intelligence. Yet from the point of view of intelligence, he was infinitely more concerned with Catalonia. He longed to be there, and although La Flèche was at present dashing into the South Atlantic in the same magnificent style as that with which she had traversed the Indian Ocean, he was obliged to command his mind with unusual force, to prevent it breaking out into sterile impatience and complaints. He thought that York might well be right about Canada, but he could not care a great deal about the hypothetical naval war. If it took place, many men on both sides would no doubt be killed or cruelly maimed. A great many women would be made bitterly unhappy. A great deal of energy, material, and treasure would be wasted, diverted from the only real contest. But whatever the event, the war would remain a side issue, a piece of wanton, bloody foolishness. He wished Jack and York would be less prolix, less inclined to neglect music for the American Navy. He was tired of their ideal squadrons, their strategy, and their new naval bases. The American Navy was the staple diet of conversation. The American Navy, day after day after day. To escape it, he spent more time on deck or in the mizzen-top. They were in Albatross waters now, running up the cold current to the west of Africa, and long did he gaze for those splendid wings over the long greenish swell. But when the darkness, or the cold, and it was unusually cold, so cold that he blessed the day he had landed his marsupials, creatures subject to bronchial complaints, drove him down to the gunroom, there he always found the Americans again. And not only their frigates, but every one of their 8 brigs and sloops, from the Hornet 20 to the Viper 12, with every wearisome detail of shifting guns and boat carronades, swivels in the tops and along the gangway. Here the feeling was quite different. Mr. Warner had no fear for Canada, no fear for Halifax, nor did he give a rap for the American Navy. And as he was the only man aboard who had fought the Americans, his opinions carried weight.
"When I was a midshipman in the year 80, sir," said he, "serving on a foul-weather Jack Byron on the American station, we saw a great deal of them. Contemptible, sir, contemptible. They never fought a single action with any credit. Filthy ships, more like privateers than a real navy. But what can you expect of people who think Commodore is a permanent rank, and who chew tobacco on the quarterdeck, squirting their spittle right, left, and centre?"
"Yet perhaps they may have improved with the passage of time," said Stephen. "I seem to remember that during their abortive little war with France in 1799, their frigate Constellation took L'Insurgente."
"Very true, sir, but you are forgetting that Constellation carried 24-pounders, and Insurgente 12s. You are forgetting that La Vengeance, who carried 18s, knocked Constellation all to pieces. And, Doctor, you are forgetting that in both these actions the Yankees were engaged with foreigners, not with Englishmen."
"Ah," said Stephen, "that I cannot deny."
"My brother Numps," said the purser. "Vengeance carried 42-pound brass carronades," said the second lieutenant, "and that I know very well, for I was third of the Seine when he took her in the Mona Passage."
"My brother Numps," said the purser,
"and these carronades were mounted on a new non-recoiling principle. Let me draw it on the cloth."
Despairing of a wider audience, the purser turned to Stephen and Maclean. But Stephen, feeling that no good could come of brother Numps, nor of the non-recoiling principle, glided from his place. The discussion carried on in the gunroom without him, still on the subject of the Americans, for it seemed that Numps had visited the United States. And it continued in the cabin, perhaps at a slightly higher level, but still very tedious for one who was not a sailor. There were times when it seemed to Stephen that they would never stop, and that boredom would be the death of him, since to escape their endless prating he was obliged either to pace the deck in the cold dampness, or to take refuge in the forepeak, which was equally cold and damp, with the reek of a charnel house added. His cabin was not altogether without comfort, but it was separated from the midshipman's berth by so thin a bulkhead that even the stout balls of wax that he thrust into his ears could not keep out their din.
"As I grow older," he reflected, "I become less tolerant of noise, boredom, and promiscuity. I never was well suited to a life at sea."
Then, abruptly, from one day to the next, La Flèche was in deep blue water. The early morning air was warm, waistcoats and comforters were stowed away, and the noonday sun was observed by a quarterdeck full of men and boys in light round jackets. Soon the jackets disappeared, and they passed under Capricorn in shirt sleeves. Dinner with the captain, which entailed full uniform, was no longer looked forward to so eagerly, except among the midshipmen, a penurious, hungry crew whose small supply of private stores bought at the Cape had long since been squandered in high living, and who were now growing thin on salt horse and biscuit no more. It was well north of Capricorn that their fantastic luck with the wind deserted them. The southeast trades had had so little south in them that La Flèche was nearer Brazil than she had intended to be when they died away altogether, leaving her wallowing on a heavy swell under a sun so huge, so very near and so furious that even at first dawn the metal of the guns was still quite hot. After a week of this, when all real recollection of the cold had vanished, when even coolness seemed to belong to some ideal existence, a faint breeze coming down from the equator directly against their wishes filled the sails at last, giving the ship life and motion. Now Warner could exert all his seamanship, the parboiled hands all their zeal, in beating slowly north. He did so with admirable skill, applauded by those, such as Captain Aubrey, who could appreciate his endeavours, ignored by others, such as Stephen and MacLean, who cared for none of these things. They had some interesting sunstrokes in their sick bay now, together with the usual diseases that some of the hands had found time to acquire in their few moments of free or stolen time at Simonstown. But still their main preoccupation was what remained undecomposed of the treasures in the forepeak, mostly bones, salted skins, and small creatures or organs in alcohol. Everything was at least catalogued by now, and much was fully described. MacLean was a fanatical describer, a dissector of wonderful dexterity, a most dogged, stubborn worker. After a day of such heat that tar dropped from the rigging and the pitch in the deck seams bubbled underfoot, perhaps the 20th of such days in succession, with all the ship's boats towing astern to keep them watertight, Stephen left him down in his private lair dissecting an eared seal's foetus, the pride of their largest jar of spirits. Although this was probably the foetus of the new species that was to be called Otaria MacLeanii, and that was to win them undying glory, Stephen could no longer bear the dense cloud of tobacco smoke, for MacLean worked with his pipe in his mouth, the fumes of alcohol, and the enclosed fetid heat after the gunroom supper of peas pudding. He wished MacLean good night, warned him not to overtax his eyes, heard his abstracted grunt, and groped his way up ladders to the deck. The watch had been set long since, and the ship was very quiet. She was slipping along under topsails alone, with the wind 1 point free, making perhaps a couple of knots through the long, easy swell. The master had the watch, and he was not one to badger the hands with jib and staysails after a wearing day hogging and boot-topping the ship's weed-grown sides for some minute increase of speed. Stephen could see him, as his eyes grew accustomed to the dark, standing near the quartermaster at the conn, in the glow of the binnacle light. Beyond him, by the taffrail, Jack was showing his midshipmen the stars, and Foreshore's high young voice could be heard piping about the Southern Cross. Such stars! The young moon had set, and they blazed there in a velvet sky, hanging, he would have sworn, at different heights, with Mars a startling red among them. A certain refreshment rose from the sea, a damp exhalation, almost cool, and Stephen walked forward across the space amidships, where in ordinary times the boats stood on their chocks, and which was now strewn with sleeping or at least recumbent figures, their heads enveloped in their jackets. He made his way through them to the bows, then carefully out along the bowsprit as far as the spritsail yard. There he turned, and, sitting easy, let himself go to the smooth motion of the ship, gazing now at the ghostly for topsail, now at the masthead, describing intricate, regular curves among the stars, and again down at the cutwater, perpetually advancing, never reaching him, shearing the black sea with a faint white gleam. There was a continual living sound of blocks heaving, the strain and slight creak of wood and cordage, the hiss and ripple and surge of the water. He was very tired, quite why he could not tell, unless it was the effort of keeping his mind from anxious, fruitless worrying about Diana. She was very present to his inward eye these days, and the events in Catalonia. Back there in the ship the bells struck one after another, and every time the sentinels called, "All's well!" from their various stations. Perhaps it was their reiterated cries that impressed their sense upon his unreasoning part, perhaps several of a thousand other causes, but after some time his tiredness was no longer a jaded, harassed fatigue, but mild, calm, physical weariness, a comfortable desire for sleep. He crept back, holding his breath and any rope that came to hand. If Jack or Bondon should discover him, he would have to endure their reproaches. He would be harshly blamed. However, he managed the descent and walked aft. Jack and his stargazers were no longer there, so after a word with the master and a long stare at the wake, the faintly phosphorescent, starlit wake with the boats black in it like little whales, he went below. Unfortunately, the midshipmen were still keeping it up. The liveliest of the ship's young gentlemen had been brought up by his uncle, an Oxford don, and he had instituted gaudy nights. This was one of them, and through his wax Stephen could hear, "Our captain was very good to us. He dipped his prick in phosphorus. It shed a light all through the night and steered us through the Bosphorus." Again and again they sang it, and again there was the howl of laughter at the end. It seemed to grow funnier with each repetition, and by four bells they could not get beyond, "Was very good to us," before they were overcome by mirth.
"Four bells, the vile brute beasts," said Stephen, ramming the wax still further home.
But five bells he never heard. He was deep, deep down, and his next impression was one of extreme, general, incoherent violence. Jack shaking him, pulling him bodily out of his cot, shouting,
"Fire, fire! The ship's on fire! Get up on deck!"
He could see almost nothing for the smoke, but snatching up a book and writing case, he followed Jack's fleeting lantern along the deserted orlop to the forehatch. The whole deck was aglow with a rosy light reflected from the smoke and the sails, and an occasional tongue of flame could be seen above the main hatchway. Hoses were playing, half-naked men heaving strongly at the pumps. He stood there for a moment in his shirt, grasping the situation, then he turned to dart down to his cabin. But the scorching smoke drove him back directly, and as he emerged, so a fountain of brilliant flame shot up from the cabin skylight. The main and mizzen topsails and all their tarred rigging took fire at once. Blazing pieces fell on the deck, starting other fires. Coils of rope, wood tinder dry, all flared with an extraordinary speed and brilliance. And now there was a vast, omnipresent roar as the main fire took an unconquerable hold. The men started from the pumps and ran to the side, all looking at Captain York.
"Starboard watch away!" he cried. "Easy, easy there! Leopards to the blue cutter!"
There was a rush for the bows, where the boats had been hauled alongside. Not an undisciplined, panic-stricken rush, but violent enough for Stephen to be thrown down and trampled upon. He found himself picked up, heard Bondon's strong voice cry,
"Make a line there!"
And there was Babington, grasping his legs and guiding him into the boat.
"Pull clear ahead!"
shouted York. And a moment later,
"Larboard watch away!"
Now the flames roared higher still. There was some confusion. Men throwing themselves into the water. Shouts of,
"Come on, sir, come on!"
But in the glare, York, Warner, and the gunner could be seen racing about the deck, firing the guns so that they should not go off at random as the heat reached them, perhaps hitting the boats. The last three guns all together, and York came down the side, the last man off the ship.
"Give way!"
he called, and his gig shot forward, passed through the rest, and led the way, pulling very fast. Presently they rested on their oars and gazed back at their ship. They gazed and gazed, with never a word. And in half an hour she blew up, a vast, crimson, lasting flash that grew with enormous speed, covering the sky, followed by a total darkness and the sound of timbers, masts, spars, plunging from the darkness into the empty sea.